Great to have you with us on the Ideas Network. Larry Mueller here. We're starting the show by taking a look at women in the brewing industry. Couple of guests for you. One of them, Brianna Willikett. She is the Wisconsin chapter leader for the Pink Boots Society. It's an organization that provides education and support to women and non-binary people in the alcoholic and fermented beverage industry. Bree, welcome to the show.
Hi, thank you for having me.
With us as well, Rob Novak. He is the Historic Brewing Experience Coordinator, which is kind of a cool title, at Old World Wisconsin in Eagle. Rob, great to have you with us as well.
Hi, Larry. Thanks for having us.
So as we talk with these two, I hope you'll join in with your own questions or comments. Let us know which women you look up to in the brewing industry, perhaps. If you work in brewing, who got you into the trade? Tell us what you know about the brewing history. Give us a call. The number is 800-642-1234, 1-800-642-1234, or you can send an email to ideas@wpr.org, ideas@wpr.org. Love to hear from you. Bree and Rob, before we get into some brewing history, perhaps, why do you think beer plays such an important cultural role in our state? And Rob, maybe start with you and then go to Bree.
Sure. Well, we're lucky today because we can see it all around us. Like most of our neighborhoods have a brewery or a brew pub or a bar that has a good selection of craft beer. And when you talk about craft beer, Wisconsin's unusual because our history deals a lot with the big breweries. A lot of them were based here. They started out fairly small, a lot like today's breweries. So what we see is this parallel between the beginning of our brewery history and what we're experiencing today. But they've all become places where we gather together, yeah. Families, friends, celebrations, or just after work to have a beer and chat about what happened. And that has not really changed in our tavern state in 150 years.
Yeah, I think so. Bree, what about you? What are your thoughts?
Absolutely. I agree 100% with Rob. I think it's a unique part of our culture here in Wisconsin, and other parts of the country might find it weird that people might bring their kids into a brewery or have a celebration around alcohol in such a profound way that we do, but I think it really brings people together in a great way.
I was in Florida once and with my daughter, who at that time was about 10, I guess. And we went into a bar mostly to get some food. And they said, well, you can't bring her in here. What are you thinking? And I said, well, back in Wisconsin, we can do that all of the time.
Yeah. Yep. When you travel, you really see it. And that has a lot to do with our history because we were a brewing state very early. I mean, the East Coast was brewing very early, but we were brewing right away, and it became part of our culture. Has a lot to do with the groups of people who moved here, of course, but also our temperature, our climate, all of that played a big role in that industry taking hold.
Yeah, and wheat. We can get to that in a minute. But Bree, what really got you or drew you to the brewing industry?
So the brewery I work at is Hinterland in Green Bay, and I started working there originally on the restaurant side. Yeah. So I was serving, hosting, and I was always kind of curious about that side of the brewery, and I kind of just started helping out. I asked one of our brewers, like, hey, if you guys are packaging one day, canning or bottling, I'd love to come see it, help out. So I started doing that. And then I didn't know that they were necessarily looking for somebody at the time to fill a position. So I was in the right time, right place. And I've been full-time there for a few years now, solely in the brewery. And it's been really fun.
You like it?
I do. I really like it.
Well, what about you, Rob? What got you into this?
It was sort of a happy accident. I was out in California, in San Diego, for a long time. And the craft beer scene out there is about 20, 30 years old. Older than in Wisconsin. So a lot of exposure. It's kind of part of the culture out there. There aren't any big breweries in that area that take hold. So a lot of craft beer, home brewing, obviously then happens after that. And then I was actually a theater student and a playwright in kind of my first career. Mm-hmm. So then when I moved back here, got into beer, started working at beer bars and breweries, and then ended up seeing the post at Old World for this historic brewing program, which is kind of half theater, half brewing. And it just clicked. It was like, okay, I need to do this.
Kind of like a perfect fit for you.
Yeah, really, really unusual situation where you find one of those jobs where you're like, this is something interesting.
So who brought beer brewing traditions to North America?
Well, North America would be Wisconsin specifically. You're looking at probably the French and English explorers. That's more of a Canadian UP thing. But the English certainly brought brewing to the East Coast very early. The first ships that came here had beer on them, and they're going to make beer when they get here. So that's how beer got here. In Wisconsin, you had settlers who were brewing with things like wild rice, wheat. Obviously, you have a lot of wheat. Barley's a trickier one in Wisconsin, but you can grow enough to make beer. So the Irish, eventually the Germans, they were not the first ones here. And maybe some of the French who stuck around long enough to brew while they were traveling.
Yeah, interesting. And it obviously goes way back. I was, you know, you've written a nice piece about the history of women in beer and it was interesting that it started with kind of farmers. I was reading that farmers made their own beer and then started making. Why not have a tavern?
Yeah, and I mean, there's ideas that perhaps civilizations, larger towns, larger cities started because people wanted to settle down enough to grow barley or to grow the grain they needed to make beer. Archaeologists go back and forth on how long people have been making what we would identify as beer. Hops weren't involved until, you know, just before the Middle Ages, but you can make beer with a lot of different spices. And then we have to normalize talking about women in beer because they were there at the beginning. They were making beer initially right away 10,000 years ago, and they're making beer today. So it's kind of like that has to be discussed and talked about, and that history needs and is being researched. It's just fascinating.
It's actually interesting. Women were the primary beer makers way back. I mean, they were all.
Yeah.
What happened? How'd that change?
Well, so it's a food product, right? It's a kitchen product, especially on a small scale. And then you had cottage brewing in the UK, with Ireland, Scotland, England, where they'd have a rooming house or a restaurant, and beer would be part of the menu. So the women who were cooking and running those places while their husbands were maybe out in the fields or doing their jobs, they would make beer too because it was a recipe item. What happened was industrialization of the industry. And as soon as companies started making beer and making more money off of beer, women were kind of cut out of that very, very quickly.
Oh, sure.
Yep. And then in Central Europe, they would go as far as women were making beer, obviously, without hops at that time. Well, as soon as hops sort of became a thing, Reinheitsgebot gets talked about a lot. But kind of the dark side of the Reinheitsgebot is, oh, you have to have hops in beer. Well, let's put taxes on hops. And that means that the women cottage brewers can't afford to buy the hops. They're making beer without hops, so let's make that illegal. And then that pretty much wiped out that industry in Central Europe.
What an amazing story. Well, let's zero in a bit more on Wisconsin for just a minute or two. And Bree, I promised I'll get to you here.
That's okay.
In just a minute. But when did they transition here in Wisconsin from sort of the home to the big?
It's a bit of a gray area. You're talking about before 1850, farmers brewing their own beer. And women on farms certainly would have been part of that because it would have been made in their kitchens. They were growing small amounts of all the ingredients they needed, hops, grain, whether it was barley or wheat. Yeast is a bit of a mystery, but they sourced yeast from somewhere. Once someone had it, then they could kind of recycle it. And what you saw was similar to Central Europe, where once it became industrialized, once you had these bigger breweries open, women weren't going to get hired for those jobs, and homebrewing kind of fell off. So you had this probably 1860s, 1870s, though the Belgians near Green Bay brewed on their farms into the 20th century, and there's stories of women helping brew on those farms.
The Best family, here in Wisconsin is responsible for starting several of Milwaukee's big breweries. And Maria Best and Captain Frederick Pabst.
Yeah. Yeah,
like the beer.
Yeah, the romance that sort of kicked off a bunch of breweries. What's funny about the Best family is they came over from Germany and really are responsible for a lot of these other breweries that ended up opening. And it's really the women in the family via marriage, for the most part, that are kind of tied to all these other breweries. And you just wonder about some of those stories in terms of the roles that were played in decisions and also just... you know, all the time you'd see a brewer pass away. Well, other brewers would swoop in to try to marry the widow and inherit, sort of take over the brewery. So you have like these men who are put on this pedestal and you realize like a lot of the time they inherited these breweries and consolidated them because they married the woman who essentially owned them once their husband died.
Yeah, the Miller family was a really interesting story to me as well, because Miller beer... you might not even have it if it hadn't have been for the Miller women.
Yeah, Frederick's mom and wife, mom and sister, sorry, in Germany paid for his education, his brewing education. His dad had died. They had a little bit of money, but his mom knew that he needed a job that would sustain him. So she funded his education, and then his sister helped fund his lease of a royal brewery. And without them, he might not have learned how to make beer in the first place.
Oh boy! So it's quite of and so now, how many women are involved in the brewing industry? Maybe Bree, I have a handle on that. I don't know, but
I don't have specific statistics on that. But I'm sure that we all realize the industry is very male dominated. So with that, there's a lot of women usually behind the scenes that you don't usually hear about. I'm sure when you go out to bars and go out to breweries that you see a lot of women pouring beer, maybe not necessarily mm-hmm. making beer, but I know a lot of women who are beer tenders. And so there are definitely a lot of women doing every aspect of brewing and doing all of the work. They're just not always highlighted in those stories. And so they kind of get, you know, buried under the guise.
Yeah, and I'm looking forward to talking with you about the Pink Boots organization as well. But, Rob, do you have any idea of how many women are involved in the brewing industry here in the state?
Not an exact number, but it's gone up. It still pales in comparison to men, of course. And there's inroads. Pink Boots is a big part of it in terms of just letting young women know, like, you can work in this industry.
Yeah.
I think the founder of Pink Boots, she actually used to tour Miller in the 70s as a Girl Scout. And I, you know, it's like, oh, Girl Scouts touring breweries is a great idea. And some maybe still do that, but she became fascinated with the idea of brewing beer. But it's, you know, at any brewery, some breweries, it maybe 25-30% women, some it's like none. It really varies depending on the choices the breweries make. They have a responsibility to try to make that choice. And hopefully they do.
And I know you list 8 women brewers in your article on women in the brewing industry. And it was tough, I imagine, to find out a lot of information about them.
Yeah, that was the challenge. We wanted to do an article about diversity in brewing history, and there really isn't any. So then I started noticing these mentions of women, especially the frontier breweries, so pre-1860, husband and wife teams. There'd just be these small mentions. And I started to compile them and realize, like, there are stories here that we may never find. But the ones that we could find, Johanna Heilemann's a big one. That's a little bit later. But the ones we did find had enough to them where it was like, there's big roles played here in these small cottage breweries.
Well, Octavia Van Dyke, I guess, is an iconic figure in the today. Who is she?
Octavia was... probably, in my research, the only woman who had a brewery named after her in Wisconsin in the 1800s. And it was through Pink Boots that I even learned about her, because they brewed a beer to honor her. They had a brewery in Green Bay. Her husband passed away. Before he passed away, he named the brewery after her, I think to encourage her to run it, or maybe that was like a gift, or maybe they talked about it. And then her sons went off to learn different parts of it while she stayed at the brewery and ran it for a decent amount of time. She had a lot of other businesses too. Her obituary is so packed that I think it doesn't even mention the brewery, or it barely mentions it. Because the Belgians up in the Green Bay, now they were Belgian, but they were brewing German beer, which is interesting. The Belgians up there had these communities that, you know, churches and businesses and all these things. It was very, very, very neat.
Yeah. Yeah, really interesting. Well, we're going to learn maybe a little more about Octavia Van Dyke, but I also want to talk about the Pink Boots organization as well, and we will get to that. And you can join in. I'm sorry I got carried away with the conversation here. It didn't give the number again, so let me do it right now. Questions or comments for our guest today, you can join in. The number to call is 800-642-1234, 1-800-642-1234, or you can email us the email address, ideas@wpr.org, ideas@wpr.org. Claire Neipert's our producer today, Trina LaSousa, our engineer. I'm Larry Mueller. You're listening to the Ideas Network. Thanks so much for being with us today on the Ideas Network. We're taking a look at women in the brewing industry today. We've gotten quite a bit into the history of women in brewing, but with our guest Rob Novak, who's the Historic Brewing Experience Coordinator at Old World Wisconsin in Eagle. But I also want to talk with a woman who's doing brewing right now, Brianna Willikett. Bree is the Wisconsin chapter leader in the for the Pink Boots Society. Questions for the two of them as we move along today. Hope you'll join in. Number to call, 800-642-1234, or you could email us to ideas@wpr.org, ideas@wpr.org. Joe in Chippewa Falls emailed. He says he loves craft beer, searching for any new breweries, not just in this state, but anywhere. He's got this small book online called 2024 Real Craft Pass. It has quite a few smaller breweries around Wisconsin. It's a great way to find more places to check out and especially try new craft beers. You familiar with that particular book, Bree?
I think there's a lot of like hop passports and beer passes like that, where you buy a book for the year and it lists a bunch of breweries around the state or the area. And so it's really cool because you can see a book of a bunch of breweries around you. You can go travel to different ones, and usually there's some type of discount or buy one, get one for a beer from that place that you visit.
Yeah. By the way, tell us about your brewery you mentioned.
Yeah, I brew, I work at Hinterland in Green Bay, so it's right next to Lambeau, so it's very, very busy. Yeah, it gets very busy, but busy is good for business. So I've been there for a few years now, originally starting front of house and now in the brewery, but it's been a lot of fun, and our team currently on the brewery side is 3 men, 3 women. Which is incredible to have a 50-50 split, because that's very uncommon. Yeah. So,
and what are your most most popular, or which beers do you like like yourself the best?
I think our staples, our lightest beer that we have on year round is our Packerland Pilsner, and it's a solid beer, has a solid name, so people who come through definitely want to try that Packerland beer. Also, our cherry wheat we have year-round now. That's with Door County Cherries, also very popular. My favorite beer that we have, it's not on year-round, but it's called Space Breakfast, and that one is, it's on nitro, so it's creamy. It's got orange, lactose, vanilla. It's kind of like an orange creamsicle. That one's my favorite.
You should have brought along a little of that for me to sample and just.
I don't have any myself. I'm sorry, I drank it all.
Well, you mentioned the cherry beer with cherry in it, and Kelly and Washburn emailed, and she's always been curious about fruit beers, and how they get that taste. Can you comment? I get to ask both of you that, but go ahead, Bree, first.
Yeah, I mean, obviously it depends what fruit, because you could add a bunch of different fruits into something and have it be great, or have it not be. But I think it really depends. It's such a broad category that if you want something particular, maybe you do really like cherries and maybe a cherry beer would be great for you. But I don't know. It kind of depends on what fruit you're using and what style of beer you're making and if it matches well and if it's of your taste.
You just get the cherries. Just get in your case, the cherries just get thrown into the. How does that work?
For that beer, we don't throw the cherries in on the brew process. It's when after it's been in a fermenter, we have pretty much a wheat based beer that we then add cherries into. So some breweries will add fruit or things on the brew deck, like maybe they'll throw an orange peel or something like that. But that particular beer we added in after the brewing process and more later into the process.
Rob, comments from you on this?
Yeah, fruit beer is, in Wisconsin we have a lot of fruit here. And it really depends on if you're doing a standard beer like a wheat beer or if you're doing a sour, like a Belgian sour. Most of us know Belgian Red from New Glarus. And that goes through a secondary fermentation on cherries where you're using the yeast that's on the cherry to spontaneously ferment to make the beer sour. So you have this kind of white. The Belgians are really to blame for fruit beer, whether you love it or you don't like it. They have a whole tradition of fruited beers. But yeah, now you see a lot of creativity. You're starting to see you've seen fruited IPAs, heavily fruited sours that taste almost soda-like. Which can be really satisfying.
In fact, I think I've still have three models from New Glarus of that, beer that you just talked about in my refrigerator as we speak. So that's kind of cool. Well, let's go back to one more thing on farmhouse ale. Alvin emailed us. He believes that farmhouse ale is one of the beers that people made early on. What is farmhouse ale, and why is it, and is it easy to make? Why is it easy to make?
Well, it's kind of got two definitions, and Bree can jump in on the modern definition. Historically, a farmhouse ale was just an ale brewed on a farmhouse. They had way less control over their yeast. They might not have understood what yeast was before the 1860s. So ale yeast is different than lager yeast. Lager yeast wasn't really here yet and needed special circumstances to brew with. So they were all ales. And then if you brewed it on a farmhouse, you'd call it a farmhouse. Now today, it's basically a specific strain of Saison yeast or Belgian yeast that gives it a flavor that's got all these esters and phenols that are sometimes clovey, sometimes peppery.
Bree, you're the, as we've been talking about here, you're the Wisconsin chapter office or leader, chapter leader, I think we should say, for the Pink Boots Society. Tell us about your organization.
Yeah, absolutely. Pink Boots Society is an international nonprofit organization. They aspire to bring women and non-binary individuals in the industry together, help educate them to further their careers. So it's really cool. There's chapters all throughout the U.S. and then also in different countries internationally. Some chapters, like the Wisconsin chapter, it's the entire state, but some bigger states or bigger communities will have their own individual chapters. So we try to host events and do educational scholarships as well to help women and non-binary people in the industry get more education and further their careers and continue growing.
And you brew lots of really, really tasty collaborations.
Yeah, that's the other fun thing about Pink Boots is every year there's a Pink Boots hop blend. And if you purchase that Pink Boots hop blend and brew a collaboration beer with that, usually there's an event associated with it. But it's kind of whatever beer, whatever style you want to make, you just use that hop blend. And the idea is that those profits from that beer go back into the organization.
I think it's Pink Boots is kind of interesting because it's kind of like an acronym in a way, because you've got sort of a charge or in every letter of Pink Boots. I'm trying to remember them. P is for passion. I remember that.
Yeah, it's a lot of letters and a lot of words to remember, but it definitely is an acronym.
Oh, Yeah, networking, there was knowledge involved, there was beer, of course, and brewing, but there's also opportunity and open exchange of ideas.
Yeah, I think it's really cool that Pink Boots brings so many people together and opens doors for people, because you might not always know where to look for support in beer, and you might feel like you're the only female in your brewery or in your area. And so having an organization like that brings everybody together and helps lift them up and give them a voice and give them support is incredible.
Yeah. A listener called, didn't stay with us, but mentioned there used to be a show on TV called Laverne and Shirley. Bree, you're not old enough to...
No, I don't think I am, but I've heard references to that before.
They two women who worked at a beer factory. You probably know that one, Rob.
Yeah, of course, and that has history in Wisconsin as well, because, you know, even before Prohibition, bottling was often done by women and children after Prohibition too. And the main reason was because the breweries could pay them less. And there's documentation, a quarter per dollar basically is what they were making around 1910 compared to what men were making. So it has a dark side too, right? Like it's great that they were involved in packaging, but it wasn't until the 50s and 60s, the strikes that were going on to try to get fair pay. But yeah, you see pictures of women bottling, like a whole room full of women bottling at Pabst in maybe the late 30s. And that's the reason, it's because they could pay them less.
Mm. So, Bree, have you seen, you've done this for how many years? Been involved in this for seven years?
Yeah, I've been full time in the brewery for about 2.5.
Yeah. So, it sounds to me like at your brewery, diversity, there's plenty of diversity.
Yeah, I mean, definitely, especially for Wisconsin, especially for our area, there are our owners there do a very good job of diversity and inclusion in their hiring practices and in the staff there. So that's incredible, but unfortunately not all businesses are like that. Not everybody makes an effort to get their staff to look like that. So there's always improvements that can be made.
Yeah. So how does Pink Boots help in that fashion?
Pink Boots is a really great resource for me to find other minorities in the industry. And so it's really nice to be able to collaborate with other people and understand their story and how they got into it and how they themselves have overcome struggles or how they have brought other people into the industry.
So what's the biggest roadblock to women, minorities getting into the, is it, I suppose it's, there's probably not just one thing.
Yeah, it's definitely a lot of factors that can contribute to it. I think what Pink Boots does with trying to provide educational opportunities to women and non-binary people is awesome, because that's one of the biggest things that's hard to do, is find that education, find a way, a resource to gain more knowledge, and just kind of getting a little bit of a head start if you can, getting into it any way that you can.
Wendy in Egg Harbor shot us an email. Could you, Bree, just go through one of your typical days? Wendy is thinking about doing this for a job, and I think may have a chance for a job in Door County, and wondering, so what's a typical day like?
Yeah, absolutely. One of my favorite things about my job is that every day is a little different. So something I might do is come in at 7 in the morning, start the bottling machines up, get everything ready for that day. The rest of the team comes in usually around 8. By then I should have the bottler mostly cleaned and set and ready to go. Then we might bottle for hours. We might then have to build an order and so pull beer from the cooler to be shipped out to our distributors. A lot of cleaning goes into brewing. So there's always a lot of cleaning upon startup and finishing with your tasks. So that might be a day, or there might be a day where we're running back and forth to the warehouse grabbing packaging. So I like, one of my favorite things to do at work is to drive the box truck, because I just feel amazing just driving that big truck. So that's one of my favorite things to do. Otherwise, it could be kegging, it could be brewing, it could be a mix of things. So there's no one set day, one set schedule that's going to be consistent, but that's what I love about it.
And then you get to interact with clients, customers, and so forth?
I definitely do a lot of interacting with my team. I think my team is a lot of fun. On the weekends, we do brewery tours, and so that's always fun, getting people in with fresh questions and just wanting to know how everything works, and having maybe some knowledge, maybe no knowledge, and being able to educate them a bit about what we do. So that's also very fulfilling.
Ned emailed. He's familiar. We're getting lots of emails here. I don't know what about our phones. I wonder if they're working. And Ned emailed us. He's a little familiar with the brewing process, but wants to know more about making sour beer. You need to sour wort. Could you go? Are there different methods, and maybe what you prefer?
Yeah, there's a couple different ways to do that. One way would be to make the wort, like actually brew wort to make beer, and then let it sour. So that's kind of the same idea as if you leave out milk and you let it sour. So I'm assuming, Rob, that's something that you've also experimented with.
Yeah, I mean, unintentionally, because the Germans were not making sour beer. But at Old World, we're brewing in the summer. It's hot, and we have a cool ship. So the wort goes in the cool ship. That's where it cools. And that anything can get in there. It's open to the air. So bacteria is a big one. Lactobacillus is a big one for souring. Acetobacter, which you kind of don't want. That's your malt vinegar kind of flavor. Those can get in there. Or you do it on purpose in the fermenter, where you add a blend of bacteria and yeast. There's some wild yeast, too. That's more of a Belgian tradition. The Germans would have dumped a batch of beer that got sour.
So what, here's another question from a listener. What tools or resources do you need to get into the business?
I think you need a resume and a phone, and you get out there and you call people and you apply. I don't know. I think there's a lot of breweries that are just willing to teach you and willing to take you in and teach you the whole process. Obviously, some places might want you to have experience or have some sort of schooling. But if you start talking to people and make connections through beer, it's not easy, but it's definitely possible to get into the industry that way.
Yeah, and Deb Carey's advice, which is great for any industry, is you start at the bottom, and you learn it to see if you actually want to do it. And in brewing, there's so many things that you can do that'll tell you, you know, within a year, like, okay, this is what this is actually about. Cleaning's the big one. Mm-hmm. And that's just a piece of advice that she puts out there to everybody in any career.
Yeah, and just to mention, probably among influential women, perhaps, in the brewing industry, Deb Carey would have to, she is president and chief executive officer of a Nuclearis Brewing Company.
Yeah,
she and her husband.
she's the president. She founded it. He's her employee. We're fortunate to have Nuclearis here and have Deb as a role model in terms of how you can operate a craft brewery. She happens to be a woman, and they're celebrating 31 years now. Pretty amazing.
Yeah, I've interviewed her on the show, and is a remarkable person and a lot of fun to talk with. You mentioned events, Bree. Are there events that are sort of public events, or are they not?
Sometimes they are, sometimes they aren't. It depends. A lot of our events through Pink Boots are for members only, because of the fact that we want to create that educational opportunity for our members. But some of the collab brew days or other events may be open to the public. There's nothing in the future that is at the moment. But if you are looking for events and stuff like that to join into, there's always events hosted at breweries, especially throughout the summer.
Yeah, and we'll get them out to Old World to brew, and that'll be public because we're open, and they come brew with us. They did the last 2 years. It's just a lot of fun. Mm-hmm. We do a rustic brew day.
So I want to make sure we get this out for people. I mean, we obviously there were some emails from people who are interested in this, perhaps wanting to know a little more about Pink Boots. What's the how do people go online to your site?
Yeah, definitely. PinkBootsSociety.org is going to be the website where you can get a bunch of information. I know the website is going to have some changes to it over the next couple months. They're updating it and refreshing it. But that's where you can visit to learn more about it, to possibly donate or become a member yourself. And then from there, you can be directed to either the Wisconsin chapter or any other chapter or resources that you might need.
So it's Pink Boots
Society.org. Yep.
Society.org. We probably have that up on our, I'm sure Claire has probably already posted it on our page, the Larry Mueller Show page. And Rob, you have, you know, you mentioned, yeah, you guys have a lot of events.
Yeah, we have events all the time. June 13th, Thursday, June 13th, we'll explore ales and lagers in Old Wisconsin. While we're open, the site's open, you'll come to the brew house, brew a little bit. We'll go out to the German farms and taste some beers. And then our festival, our midsummer festival, June 22nd, will focus on Wisconsin breweries and cheeses. And hopefully we'll have Pink Boots out there as well. And that'll be like a mini festival that's highly curated with some really unusual beers that you might have, that might have some similarities with beers that were brewed on the old farms.
So, and for there, go to Old World West. Do you need to sign up in advance for those, by the way?
Those two will be ticketed.
Yeah.
But they'll also incorporate the site itself. On any regular day, come on out when we're open, we're brewing. So the brew house will be open. I'll be in there. We'll maybe have guest brewers in there. We brew pretty much every day that we're open.
And so just go to oldworldwisconsin.org.
Yep.
.org. Or...
Or pinkbootssociety.org.
Well, I hope you'll get some clicks for that today. Thank you both so much for being with us today. It was fun learning about what's going on right now and what happened in the past when it comes to women in brewing here in Wisconsin. Appreciate it very much.
Yeah, definitely. Thank you so much for having
you,
us.
Rob Novak is the Historic Brewing Experience Coordinator at Old World Wisconsin in Eagle. And if you haven't been to Old World Wisconsin, my goodness, you should be anyway, getting out there. Brianna Willicott is the Wisconsin chapter leader of the Pink Boots Society. It's great to have them with us. And maybe we can do this again with them down the road. We'll see. Appreciate it very much. We're going to turn our attention to a place where I know there's some breweries in Wisconsin. Dells has, and I've sampled a few of them, but we're going to take a look at the history of Wisconsin Dells, and especially as it relates to one of the people who really got the Wisconsin Dells on the map, H.H. Bennett. Great photographer, and we'll learn some more about him, and we'll learn some more about the Wisconsin Dells next. I'm Larry Mueller for the Ideas Network. Well, the Wisconsin Dells calls itself the water park capital of the world. 4 million people visit the city each year. But before all the water slides and roller coasters, the Dells was a quiet place begging to be photographed. And for that, enter Henry Hamilton Bennett, H.H. Bennett, the man who kind of made Wisconsin Dells famous. Larry Mueller here on the show. Thanks for taking time to be with us today as we take a look at Wisconsin Dells history with our guest, David Rambo. He is the site director for the H.H. Bennett Studio and Museum in the Dells. And it's going to be great to talk with him about Bennett and the Dells. And I hope you'll join in with your own comments or maybe your own memories of the Wisconsin Dells. Why do you go back every year, maybe? Do you find yourself wanting to take your own pictures of its natural beauty? There's plenty there. The number to call is 800-642-1234, 1-800-642-1234, or send an email to ideas@wpr.org. David Rambo, welcome. Thanks for taking time to be with us today.
I'm here, Larry, and thanks so much for squeezing us into your schedule. I've enjoyed the show for a while, and especially today about the brewery and brewing. And you're making me thirsty, but I'm stuck here in my office looking over Broadway, which is the main street here in Wisconsin Dells. And this time of year is pretty quiet, but you couldn't tell that for the summer. It gets pretty busy downtown.
Yeah. Well, as I said kind of in the intro, the town is full of amusement parks and resorts, but it always hasn't always been that way. So I did want to travel back a bit, maybe to the middle of the 19th century. So set the scene for us. What was the town like back in the middle of the 19th century?
Sure. The Dells was established, the city, in 1856. And they were, looking at this river, but not for entertainment and tourism. It was a working river. And 170 years ago, this was called Kilbourne or Kilbourne City, and it was named in honor of the railroad's president, who's a very controversial figure, and we don't have time to talk about Mr. Kilbourne. But it was a working city for many, many years, and then tourism kind of took the place over, and that's where we are today.
Yeah. You're the site director for the H.H. Bennett Studio and Museum. And who was H.H. Bennett?
Sure. Henry Hamilton Bennett, it's quite a handle. He was born in Canada in 1843, the eldest of 12 children, which in those days was, fairly common.
Mm-hmm.
And in the 1850s, 1857, there was they called it the financial panic of 1857, and it swept the United States primarily because there was a shortage of gold. And it got people moving around. And for some reason, a lot of people from the state of Vermont set their eyes on this part of Wisconsin. I think it was because the railroad had just, ended here, come through the city. The grass was greener, in mm-hmm. Wisconsin for these people from Vermont. At that time, Bennett's parents were living in Vermont. They'd moved from Canada several years earlier. And the father, George, his uncle, George Houghton, who was a photographer, and little teenager, Henry Hamilton Bennett, he was 16 years old, came down here to kind of test it out and see what life would be like in Kilbourne City, Wisconsin.
When was it renamed, by the way?
In 1931. People in those days, there was no GPS, of course. So you're looking on a map, you're looking for Wisconsin Dells, and where in the heck is the Wisconsin Dells? So the city changed the name because of the tourists, better finding this location.
So Bennett got himself to Wisconsin. The Civil War started, and was Bennett involved in that? I'm trying to remember the timing.
Oh, yeah. He came down here as a young boy. He's a teenager. He was an apprentice carpenter, and that was his father's main occupation. So he swept up, and he learned how to use tools and how to work around a carpentry shop. And that great calamity today we call the American Civil War happened in spring of 1861. Like many of the youngsters of his age, he became very excited about the opportunity to serve his country and fight for the Northern cause in the American Civil War. So he joined in 1861 in a group called the 12th Wisconsin Infantry. And they rode what they called the cars, which is the railroad, down to the middle of our southern states, and they were in what we call the Western Theater of the American Civil War, seeing many really bloody battles.
Yeah, the 12th of Wisconsin is featured prominently in many histories of the Civil War.
Mm-hmm.
So he saw a lot of action.
Yeah, unfortunately, he did. And yeah. You can imagine his fervor for being in the Army and being in this active war kind of dampened, you know, quite a bit after being away from home and in this dangerous situation for several years.
But he made it, obviously. And how did he develop an interest in photography?
It was happenstance. An unfortunate incident happened in spring of 1864. As many, you know, infantry privates, Mr. Bennett, Henry Hamilton, took his part in his place in the Army, and at nights, oftentimes they took turns doing picket duty, which was, you know, being a sentry on the outside of the camp, just making sure there are no enemies prowling about that are going to cause you harm. One of those nights, he thought he heard a noise, and he wasn't there. He couldn't figure out what it was. He yelled, "Halt, who goes there?" No answer. And so he stood up on a rotten log, unfortunately put his right hand on the barrel of his musket. Oh. The rotten log collapsed, I've been told, and sending a bullet through the fleshy part of his right palm, and out, the bullet came out right under his index finger. And that ended his career in the military as well as his carpentry career. You know, he was trained as a Finnish carpenter, and he couldn't do that anymore. So all of a sudden, you're set up with the situation where you don't know what you're going to do anymore. You know, you're out of the military, no real prospects, and what do you do? So he came back to the Dells, or what was then called Kilbourne, and found his way on his own. And photography was that way he found to change his life as well as add to what's going on here in this local community.
Well, some of the most iconic photos that we see of the Dells, he took.
Right. He was here early, and so he knew a lot of the haunts and the places that people would congregate and some of the wonderful, breathtaking views we have here. I'm sure most of your viewers have been here before, but the river, the Wisconsin River, is surrounded by these huge sandstone formations that rise out of the water. And the sandstone cliffs you see today are only found in three other areas in the world: Switzerland, Germany, and several parts of New York. So very, very unique structures, you know, these cliffs. And it's something that was just screaming for people to see. And so he was able to photograph some of those really iconic vistas and send them east so people could come and look at him for themselves.
Yeah, was that his role in a way? I mean, he was a great photographer, and I'm sure he wanted to sell his photos, but was part of his idea all along to make Wisconsin Dells a place that people wanted to come to and attract people to the place?
I mean, he certainly, you know, he and his wife, Frances, or he called her Frankie or Frank, were a good team. They were boosters for the city, and they'd invite people into their shop, into their downtown location to have their portraits done. Also, tourists would come in and ask, you know, where's a good place to get a meal in town? Where do I find a good place to stay? Where do I find fishing gear? Where's a good cigar? You know, that sort of question.
Yeah.
Oddly enough, they sent those people to their friends, but they really were kind of like the unofficial Chamber of Commerce. Now, Bennett himself, I've been told, didn't really like the atmosphere in the portrait studio, just the drudgery of every day taking the same sort of image over and over. So he taught his wife how to do the studio portrait stuff, the chemistry, as well as the actual techniques and technology of the camera of that time. So he could have his time freed up to kind of gallivant around the river and take, you know, these images that really are the main images we think of Mr. Bennett today outdoors.
Yeah. David Rambo, our guest today, he is the site director for the H.H. Bennett Studio and Museum in the Wisconsin Dells. And he'll be with us right up until 12:30 today. We've got lots to talk about regarding the Dells and Bennett. And I hope you'll join in. You can give us a call. The number is 800-642-1234. 1-800-642-1234. Or you could email us, the email address, ideas@wpr.org. We'll take a look at the news, find out what else is in store for us here on the Ideas Network, and then we'll be back with David Rambo. I'm Larry Mueller for the Ideas Network. Great to have you with us on the Ideas Network. Larry Mueller here. We're talking about a slice of Wisconsin Dells history on the program today with our guest, David Rambo. He is the site director for the H.H. Bennett Studio and Museum in the Dells. So as we talk with David, I hope you'll join in. Let us know which Wisconsin photographers and artists maybe inspired you, or why do you love the natural beauty of the Dells, or what are your experiences at the Dells? You can call us at 800-642-1234, 1-800-642-1234, or send an email to ideas@wpr.org, ideas@wpr.org. Love to hear from you. David, the Bennett Studio was constructed back in 1875, if I'm not mistaken, and it's considered the oldest operating photographer's business in Wisconsin.
Isn't that something?
Yeah.
And as far as we know, it's true. You know, the oldest operating studio, you know, photography location in the state, at least. We're downtown on Broadway, and oftentimes we're surrounded with so many interesting things, we're kind of lost in the shuffle. So people find us, and they ask, well, how long have you been here? since 1875, you know, so it's kind of fun.
Oh, so how did it, I mean, how did Bennett, did he have some money to put this studio together, or how did that all work out?
Well, he originally bought a secondhand sort of ramshackle tin type gallery, they called it, across the street from where the present location is today. He had a dream of having a purpose built photography studio, complete with a skylight, you know, and all the backdrops you could roll up and down, and a dark room, and, you know, everything would be right there, as well as a processing center where you could take these images and mount them on cards and things. Unfortunately, he didn't have the money. So luckily, he had connections, and he had a friend who was also a photographer up in the Milwaukee area named William Metcalf, who was in those days, in the 1870s, a bona fide millionaire.
Oh.
Metcalf had made his money selling boots and shoes and leather goods to the Union Army in the American Civil War. So he had his life pretty much made, and he was always looking to help other people in their artistic ventures. And he loaned Bennett $3,230, and that built this whole entire studio. Bennett couldn't pay it right away, so he paid him in increments of $19 a month for several years to pay, you know, Mr. Metcalf back.
Oh, man. And so his wife was primarily doing the portraits, and that was that a popular kind of thing back in the day, that portrait?
Well, not at first, of course. In the 18, you know, he started here in 1865, right after the war, when he, you know, had hurt himself. Right away, this wasn't really known as a tourist destination, and so they were kind of living hand to mouth the first few years. They decided, Frankie and Henry, or sometimes they're called Frank and Hank, to take their show on the road. You know, if people wouldn't come here, they would go to Sparta and Toma and some of the smaller cities, you know, around Kilburn City with a tent. And they would do, you know, portrait photography on glass plates as negatives and also on metal steel plates they called tintypes. And so they did a lot of that work around and about, and that kind of got them going until the tourism really started to kick in. A lot of that was, you know, related to Mr. Bennett getting his photo images of the landscapes out there. So it all worked together.
Well, those landscape photos are amazing. Leaping the Chasm is probably one of the most famous photographs. And for those, and I've seen it, and I bet a good percentage of the people listening today have seen that photograph. But describe it for us.
Well, in those days, you know, in the 1870s and the 1880s primarily, one of the goals of photography all around the world was to capture an image that would freeze movement. Up until that time, the subjects had to stand very still because an exposure on a camera took 3 to 5 seconds, even in the bright daylight. And if you moved at any time during that time, you'd be forever immortalized as just this blur that nobody could identify. And so one of Bennett's goals, along with other people in our world, was to find a shutter that was fast enough and film that was fast enough to capture an image that froze that movement. He, along with many, many others, were working on that problem. So he wasn't the only one, but he developed a shutter that worked with the spring made from a rubber band. He called it the snapper. And you'd push a button and that snapper would open and close relatively faster than your fingers could take the lens cap off and put it back on. And lo and behold, he, with the new film and this new snapper, he was able to stop the motion of his son leaping from a cliff line to a pillar of stone they call Leap Rock on the northern part of the Wisconsin River. An unknown part of that story, Mr. Bennett was a perfectionist. And so the first try wasn't quite good enough. So he had his son Ashley, hey, why don't you try that again? We'll see if we can get a better pose as you're leaping. And as it turned out, Ashley ended up doing at least 17 jumps before Mr. Perfectionist Bennett got it where he thought that was the best he could do. So,
wow, and, you know, there are no nets or anything.
No, there weren't then.
Luckily, man.
Luckily, when you're a 16-year-old, you think you're immortal, you know?
So yeah.
I doubt he thought of the danger, but I'm surprised the dad didn't. And I've often wondered what he told the mother.
There are other photos of dogs doing that same jump.
Mm-hmm. And yet to this day, if you take an Upper Dells, you know, boat run, they'll let you off the boat and you go up, walk a little path up to Stand Rock where all this history happened. And they still have a dog that will go over and then back. And I guess if you're not fast enough, that dog really goes bing-bong pretty quickly, and you can miss it. But they let the dogs do it, but they don't let humans make that leap anymore.
What was Bennett's day like? What's the average work day like for him?
As the years went by, he became very popular. not here just in the Wisconsin Dells, but in Milwaukee and Chicago. And he did a lot of traveling about promoting the city, promoting his photography, and doing jobs. You know, a lot of times in Milwaukee, he did landscapes, you know, the shipyards and very wealthy people's, I guess you could call them mansions. So he did a lot of traveling and a lot of work outside of the city. Other than that, he would go to the same locations that he'd always loved and take the same images over and over and over, trying to, you know, improve upon what he'd done before.
Go ahead. Oh, I just Jean in Sun Prairie had emailed us a question about, well, she has not been to the museum, but very intrigued. Are there photos of the indigenous people of the time? Did he take photos of indigenous peoples?
Wonderful. I almost forgot that. The people living here, the indigenous people at that time, of course, were the Ho-Chunk. In those days, they were called the Winnebago, but it's the same. You know, the real name of the tribe is the Ho-Chunk, and they'd lived here, you know, from time immemorial. Bennett, in his travels up and down the river, became acquainted with the Ho-Chunk people and was even for a time invited into their camp to do some photography. And so, of course, the images he did, he wasn't trying to... He was not an ethnographer. He wasn't trying to, you know, provide historical look on these people, but he did just that, you know. He was trying to just make money for his studio and for himself by selling these images. But he did a good thing because a lot of times these images are the only existing images we have of a lot of these the people who lived here.
He was... You mentioned that shutter speed thing that he kind of invented with a rubber band spring type thing. But he invented other things as well, didn't he, related to photography?
Yeah, one of the major things that we brag about here is in those days, to make a print from a glass negative, you would take it outside in a special holder that would hold the negative stationery. Underneath it, you'd have a piece of light-sensitive photo paper, and you'd set it out for a minute or so, and it had to be directly under the rays of the sun to get a good, crisp print. Well, as we know, as the Earth moves, that sun seems to be in a different place all day long, and so photographers all over the world would have to readjust the rack that they had these in to get good prints. Well, Bennett invented a system where the building, the little, it looked like a chicken coop with a rack on the front. He had a wheel put in there that was hooked up to a cable that as the sun would seem to move during the day, you would take that cable and move it a few degrees every hour, and that would keep you facing that sun directly. So instead of moving the rack, you move the whole building. And person who provided the money for the building, Mr. Metcalf, discouraged him from doing that because it was just a little too far out. But it seemed to have worked. And when this building was finally put on the National Register in 1976, the Smithsonian showed up, and they took that little building or the remains of it, and it's somewhere in the Smithsonian Institute now.
Oh.
Somewhere.
How did it land on the that historic, as a historic site?
Well, of course, Mr. Bennett and his wife didn't live forever. He died in 1908 and on New Year's Day. And luckily, he had daughters that ran this business in the 1920s and 30s, and then a granddaughter that took the business over, and she and her husband ran this, and then their kids took up the cause until about 1998. And between the 1970s and the 1990s, things were changing in photography, as you can imagine. You know, digital was coming in finally. They, you know, were like fish out of water. They couldn't keep up with all the new technology. But they decided to, you know, donate this building, and they did, luckily, to the Wisconsin Historical Society. And so our organization has been a caretaker for this site ever since.
Wow, that's quite a story. Did Bennett, did he ever become wealthy?
For his time, I believe he was, you know, upper middle class. He had in his head kind of what my dad had, you know, living through the Depression in the 1930s. He always felt the wolf was going to be at the door if he didn't, you know, be very frugal with his money. And Bennett was much the same. He was always looking for a good deal and not, you know, just spending squanderous amounts of money. So he did okay for himself in his time. Unfortunately, as photography changed in his time, in his lifetime, people had their own cameras by 1900, little box cameras that they called them box cameras. They could handheld hold those. And you could take your own photos of you in the landscape. You didn't need a photographer to take your portrait anymore. So a lot of things changed even during his lifetime. So I'm sure that had to do with his, you know, worries about where the money is going to come from in the next few years.
Yeah. He produced his images, or many of them, in stereo views. Describe that.
Sure. I don't know if, you know, many of your listeners are familiar with the concept of a stereo view. My grandmother had some of these in the attic when I was a kid, and I'd always get in trouble looking at them. But basically what it is a cardboard card, which is, you know, about 7 inches long and about 3 inches tall. And they look really strange because it's the same image twice on the front, one right next to the other. And it looks exactly the same, although the camera that took that picture had two lenses on it. So they're very, you know, slightly different. If you put it in the right kind of viewer with two magnifying glasses and hold it up to your face, it looks like it's three-dimensional. And, oh, my God, you know, these are black and white pictures. But in those days, that was a marvel in the 1870s. It was like virtual reality today, you know, it was seen as that. Now, as things progressed in time, when I grew up as a kid, we had a version of that. We called it the ViewMaster.
I had one of those.
Did you? Yeah. And these kit things were marketed for children mostly. And, you know, I had Disney reels and the look at the Grand Canyon and a lot of, you know, things like that. And those little two images would be on a reel instead of on a flat card, and you could just advance it by pulling down a lever. So I'd love to see the ViewMaster come back. I'm looking for places that still make them today, although I'm not having any luck so far.
David, tell us more about the museum, the Bennett Studio and Museum. What do people see when they come there?
Well, sure. Right now, our entrance is through what was at one time the post office, and it's called the Marshall Building, and it's where we have, of course, the first important thing people see is the gift shop. Now, we're one of the few places, if not the place, in the Wisconsin Dells that actually has a bookstore. So you can buy books on photography, of course, Mr. Bennett, other subjects of local history and interest. Going through the gift shop, then you go into our museum, which is talking a lot about the subjects that we just covered, you know, in the last few minutes. Mr. Bennett, how he got into photography, his encounters with the Ho-Chunk people, what are stereo views, we have examples of those to look at, what a blurry picture looks like, and how he solved that, you know, with his snapper shutter. And in and amongst all this, interspersed are cameras and technology that are not like the things he used. They are the exact things that he used during his lifetime. Luckily, his descendants were what many people might call hoarders today. I mean, they kept everything, even his invoices and paid bills and things. So there's a wealth of, you know, information and 3D items that we have in the museum to show what his life and what his times were like. You get to the end, you can walk into the original 1875 studio, which has been preserved about as it looked in 1900. And if you have time, you can even pose, and I can do a tintype of you or a glass negative of you using the same chemistry and the same techniques as the great Mr. Bennett did in his day. Leaving that, you come back into the gift shop, of course, before you leave. But before you get to that spot, we have imagery and photographs done by Mr. Bennett's grandchildren and his great-grandchildren, which are what we call the golden age of Dell's tourism. And that's that little space, I think, is the most important space for most people when they come here, because they're showing their kids or their grandkids what they saw when they were first here. And it's living memory that is the most important thing here in our museum.
Yeah, the photos. And do you have any of Bennett's originals?
We do, you know, in the exhibit. Mm-hmm. We do have original stereo views, of course, as well as a lot of his larger format photography. Some of them are called panorama photography. They're over 6 feet long. And there was no negative big enough to take one image like that. And so what he would do is take three negatives, glass, of course, and then piece those together. And without the aid of Photoshop, make these panoramas look like one seamless long view of the river or of the buildings or something like that. It's just incredible.
It's an amazing thing to see. And there's a small charge to get into this to the museum.
There is, yeah. Right now, we open in Memorial Day weekend this season, and it's just a $10 charge, you know, to get in. And for children, a lot less, and for seniors and veterans, you know, of course, a lot less as well. But people are kind of hesitant. They don't know what this is going to be. But once they've gone through, we don't get a bad word. You know, they're very happy they came through and looked through the building.
Well, I tell you what, it's been a lot of fun talking with you today, David, about Bennett and about the Dells and about his life. And I appreciate it very much. Thank you so much for being with us today. Are you online, by the way?
Yes, we are. It's, of course, just with the Wisconsin Historical Society, just hhbennett.org. WHS.org. So look us up, and we hope to see some of you people next summer.
Thanks again. David Rambo is the site director of the H.H. Bennett Studio. Fun talking with him. Tomorrow we'll talk about the last ice age and how it shaped our state and left behind the wetlands so many of us love. Thanks for listening. Stay with us. Lots in store on the Ideas Network. I'm Larry Mueller.